Hello, and welcome to Saugate Khaas. I'm Sara, and today, over a cup of chai, we're asking a big, warm question. Where do our tastes, our zaiqe, actually come from? By the way, if you can smell something right now, close your eyes for a second. Hold that for a beat.
सारा, नाइस ओपनर. हाय एवरीवन, मैं हूँ हमजा. मैं एक न्यूरोसाइंटिस्ट हूँ और एक बिट ऑफ अ फूड कल्चर नर्ड, और मैं एग्जैक्टली इसी पर तहकीक करता हूँ कि स्मेल, मेमोरी और इमोशन हमारे जायके को कैसे शेप करते हैं. सो लेट्स डिग इन.
सो फर्स्ट, सिंपल बट ट्रिकी, व्हाट डू वी मीन बाय टेस्ट? पीपल से आई लाइक स्पाइसी, आई लाइक स्वीट, बट आई फील लाइक दैट्स ओनली पार्ट ऑफ इट. हमजा, take us through that split, gustation versus flavor.
Right. This is where people often get confused. Scientifically, taste, gustation, refers to the basic categories detected by the tongue: sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and umami. But what we usually mean by zaiqa is flavor, which is taste plus smell plus texture, temperature, even the crunch, the look, the setting. So most of what makes a biryani biryani to you is actually the smell and the whole sensory package, not just the taste buds.
Interesting. So when I say dadi ke haath ki biryani, it's more than just salt and chili. It's a whole sensory memory package. Wow.
Exactly. Aur yahan ek key point. Smell plays the biggest role. When we chew, volatile molecules travel up the back of the throat into the nasal cavity. This retronasal smell is critical. The olfactory bulb then sends signals right into the brain's emotion and memory centers, like the amygdala and hippocampus, without the usual relay the way vision does. That's why smells can drop you right back into an afternoon in your grandmother's kitchen.
So that explains those sudden full body memory hits. Like, I'll be at a grocery store and a spice hits me and bam, I'm 7 in Karachi again. Hamza, there's that Proust Madeleine story we all use. Is that really a real effect?
Yes, it's real in the sense that science supports it. The Proust phenomenon, the idea that a smell or a food can produce a vivid autobiographical memory, is backed by research. Studies show that odors are more effective than pictures or words at triggering rich, detailed personal memories. Those memories tend to be older, more vivid, and more emotional. Researchers even use the acronym LOVER, limbic, old, vivid, emotional, rarely rehearsed, to describe odor-evoked memories.
LOVER. I love that. Limbic, old, vivid, emotional, rarely rehearsed. Okay, that helps. So the science is really mirroring our desired intuition, that smells from the kitchen carry whole stories. But tell me, do these smell memories do anything else besides giving us a nice nostalgia trip?
Yes, they do more than nostalgia. Smell-evoked memories can improve mood, increase feelings of social connectedness, and even affect physiology. Some studies show changes in stress markers and immune signals when people experience these nostalgic smells. There are also findings showing that in early Alzheimer's, people can sometimes retrieve richer memories when cued by familiar smells than by other cues. So, smells can be therapeutic in a way.
That's powerful. I remember my mamma's murabba scent. It could make my whole day better. So, there's a science to why that matters.
Absolutely. And it's not only the emotional side, it's also about development. From infancy, our palates are being shaped. Flavors of a mother's diet can appear in breast milk, exposing babies to local food profiles before solids start. Repeated exposure to a flavor during childhood strongly shapes whether we later like it or not.
Right. I've read that too. In my own life, growing up between Karachi and Toronto, I remember how the flavors at home set the standard. When friends offered me Western snacks, I thought, okay, but this isn't really food as I know it. Hamza, what about the part where kids hate something initially, but later learn to love it?
That's the classic acquired taste. Repeated positive exposure helps. A child might dislike bitter vegetables at first, but if the family regularly serves them in cousin contexts, with familiar condiments or paired favorites, over time they can develop a preference.
cultural norms and family practices, how often, how it's served, train the palate.
So, families are like little culinary academies, each home with its own curriculum.
Exactly. Each household is a microculture of taste. Different salt levels, different spice mixes, different textures. Kids internalize that this is normal and later use it as a reference point. When they marry or move, they suddenly notice how other people do the same dish differently, saltier or with a different tadka, and it can be jarring.
Oh yes, I remember eating at my friend's home in Toronto. Her mom's dal had more cumin, whereas my ammi's dal had a sharper garlic tadka. I almost had a small identity crisis. Hamza, can you talk a bit about how recipes are actually taught? Because in our homes, it's rarely written down.
That's a great point. In many Desi kitchens, recipes are transmitted by watching and doing. Elders use sensory cues. When the oil separates, when the aroma comes, or thoda sa namak. These are embodied instructions. This andaza culture means skill and repetition count more than strict measurements. It's oral, practical knowledge, intangible cultural heritage, if you like.
Right. Thoda sa can mean a teaspoon or a handful, depending on who's speaking. I tried to write down Dadi's achar recipe once. Disaster. She kept saying, just tahu, jab aap haath saaf karo, tab theek ho jayega. I had to call her 3 times to clarify.
That's classic. A younger generation often translates andaza into teaspoons and cups, which can be awkward. But even when you write it down, a recipe still needs practice. Elders measured by feel because they've repeated it hundreds, thousands of times. That practical knowledge is hard to transfer in text alone.
So skills matter. And often the person who holds those skills is, let's be honest, usually the woman in the family. That carries emotional labor too, right?
Yes. In many households, grandmothers and mothers are keepers of culinary knowledge. And much of that labor is unpaid and gendered. Hospitality rituals, making elaborate dishes for guests, spending hours on pickles, are often performed by women, even as the family's honor or prestige is shared by all. So when we celebrate the taste, we should also notice the labor behind it.
That's an important nuance. And speaking of hospitality, mehman nawazi, it's such a central cultural value. Can we unpack how food operates as a language of relations?
Sure. Feeding guests is a form of social currency. In South Asian culture, hosts often offer their best food, rich versions with extra ghee or nuts, even if daily fare is simpler. The ritual of insisting a guest eat, aap hamare mehman hain, or guest ki polite refusal are part of a script that builds social bonds. Food becomes a way of expressing care and honor.
I still remember my mother's insistence when guests came. You must eat, you must eat. It was a whole performance, but one that made me feel proud. Hamza, do these rituals affect how food is remembered?
Yes, very much. When foods are embedded in ritual and social contexts, Eid breakfasts, wedding feasts, neighborhood iftars, they become memory anchors. Smells and tastes tied to those events are more likely to trigger vivid emotional memories because they were lived socially and repeatedly.
And that's why sometimes a simple chai can feel like a festival if it's shared the right way.
Exactly. Context matters a lot. One more cultural point. Hamari cuisines are historically layered. What we think of as home food carries pre-Islamic regional ingredients, Central Asian and Mughal influences, colonial era introductions like tea and baking, and modern globalization with fusion dishes. So home taste is actually centuries of mixing.
That's such a comforting idea that there isn't a single pure origin, but a long conversation across generations and borders. It makes me think of the Desi Chinese craze. People sometimes wrinkle their noses, but it's just another layer of adaptation.
Yes, food has always hybridized. Authenticity is not purity. It's continuity of meaning. An instant pot biryani might be practical, but it can still carry the same significance of gathering and celebration.
Hamza, earlier you mentioned infants and breast milk. Could you expand on how early exposure affects adult taste? I think listeners will find that fascinating.
Sure. Flavors from a mother's diet can pass into breast milk, so babies encounter garlic, spices, other local flavors before solids. Early exposure shapes expectations and preference windows. Combine that with repeated exposures during childhood and you get a strong imprint of what's normal. That's why someone raised with mirch and masala often grows up to prefer spicier food than someone who wasn't.
That explains so much. And those early months also tie into memory, right? Like smell cues from home can bring up very early memories.
Yes, odor evoked memories are often older compared to those evoked by visuals, frequently reaching into early childhood. Because olfactory pathways connect so directly to memory centers, smells can retrieve memories that we otherwise wouldn't access. That's part of why those chutney or achar smells can feel like time machines.
Time machines. Love that. Acha, switching gears, why do some traditional flavors feel like they're disappearing? Are they really dying out?
They're changing, not uniformly disappearing. Several pressures push traditional practices. Urbanization and time scarcity make long, slow-cooked dishes harder to maintain. Convenience foods and branded masala mixes homogenize flavors. Migration changes ingredient availability, and changing gender roles alter who has time to cook. So some rituals like sun-drying mangoes on rooftops for achar become rarer, while other traditions adapt.
I see. So maybe we should term it transformation rather than extinction.
Yes, transformation. Though there's a real loss of some house-specific variations when everyone uses the same ready-made masala. Small differences, like how long to fry an onion or whether to add a pinch of ajwain, are the signatures of each household. When convenience standardizes that, you lose a layer of diversity.
And it's personal too. My ammi used to sun-dry chilies on the balcony and now she uses store-bought dried ones. It tastes different, but also practical. I get it.
Exactly. There's often a tension. Elders lament changes or youth embrace convenience or new flavors. Migration complicates it further. Ingredients are unavailable or expensive, so recipes adapt. But in diaspora, food can get more symbolic. People may hold on to certain dishes more tightly as an emotional passport to home.
Yes. My family in Toronto would make masala chai exactly the way Ammi taught, even when everything else had shifted. It's like a little piece of home in a cup. Hamza, are there misconceptions about taste that we should clear up?
Definitely. Misconception one, taste is only the tongue. Not true. Smell, texture, temperature, even sound and sight contribute heavily. Misconception 2, desi food is always unhealthy. Not true either. There's a deep tradition of simple, balanced daily foods like dal, sabzi, roti and yogurt. Context matters. Misconception 3, elders have magic hands. They actually have practice skill, often over years. Misconception 4, modernizing equals losing authenticity. As we said, cuisines have always evolved, so adaptation is part of survival.
Definitely. Acha, mujhe ek baat batao. Ab let's get concrete. Aur ek thoda sa cheeky sa challenge. Sara style challenge. What's one small thing listeners can try this week to taste memory?
One small experiment. Cook or sip something that you associate with home, but do it mindfully. Notice the smell first, close your eyes, and see what memories come up. Even just pausing to savor a spoonful of dal or a piece of achar can trigger those lover-type memories, and it might change your mood. It's a tiny, accessible practice.
Nice. I'll try it tomorrow morning with chai and leftover paratha. And another idea, recorded dadi making a recipe on your phone. Those andaza instructions are disappearing unless someone captures them.
Yes, documentation helps. Younger people are using voice notes and videos to archive recipes and rituals. That preserves more than the ingredients. It captures gestures, phrases like jab tel se khushbu aane lage, and other embodied cues.
Hamza, quick flip. What's one surprising scientific fact about smell and memory we haven't said yet? Give me a little trivia.
Okay, ek neat bit. Odor-evoked memories are often rarely rehearsed. That means they're tucked away or don't come up in normal conversation.
a smell can suddenly retrieve a detailed, emotional scene you haven't thought about in decades. So smells access a different kind of archive than pictures or stories do.
Rarely rehearsed. So our noses are like secret librarians. I love that image.
Yes, secret librarians with spice racks. Another practical point, when someone's nose is blocked, flavors diminish dramatically because retronasal smell is cut off. People who've had COVID discovered that food loses richness when smell is gone.
Oh, true. I remember that wave when everyone said, "I can't taste anything." Suddenly the science was a headline. Moving on. Let's talk about identity. How does what we eat tell the world who we are?
Food signals many identities. Religious practices like halal, fasting for Ramadan, regional tastes such as Sindhi biryani versus Hyderabadi biryani, and ethnic or linguistic markers. When you cook and eat a certain dish, you're announcing a history. A cuisine is a social statement of belonging. This is why food is central to identity politics and diaspora life.
Right. I used to feel more desi when I could make a specific chutney meri ammi banati thi. It's funny how taste anchors belonging. Hamza, tell me about the role of gender change in food traditions. It's subtle but real.
As more women work outside the home, the old expectation that they alone handle all culinary rituals becomes unsustainable. Some families simplify dishes, share cooking duties, or adopt convenience foods. That can mean loss of some elaborate traditions, but it can also open space for shared kitchens and new experiments. So it's both a loss and a possibility for more egalitarian practices.
So it's complicated, like most things. I want to pause and ask you something more personal, Hamza. Tell me about your own palate. What's one dish or smell that still takes you home?
Sure. My earliest strong smell memory is Ammi's dal with its cumin garlic tadka. Even during my PhD years in the UK, the first time I smelled that combination, I felt immediately grounded. I also have memories of hostel canteens, cheap karahi whose smell meant community for students. And together, these shaped my research interest in how smell links to memory.
I love that student karahi and Ammi's dal sitting side by side in your memory. For me, it's the smell of fresh coriander over hot chana. It still transports me to Karachi markets and my dadi stirring achar under the sun.
Such vivid personal anchors. Aur wo anchors bahut private aur social hain. Aur jab aap unhe share karte hain, to listeners unke apne echo sun sakte hain. That's a great reason to make this podcast, to surface those stories.
Exactly. Okay, Hamza, let's do a small myth-busting rapid round. I say a phrase, you respond. Ready?
Go for it, Chad.
Smell doesn't affect memory.
Wrong smell is one of the strongest cues for autobiographical memory, often producing older and more vivid memories than visual or verbal cues. And it's tightly connected to limbic structures.
Nice. All traditional food is unhealthy.
Wrong traditions include both heavy celebratory dishes and simple everyday balanced foods. Context and moderation matter more than blanket labels.
If you modernize a dish, it's not authentic.
Also, wrong cuisines have always hybridized. Adaptation can preserve meaning even as methods change.
Perfect. Now, we promised listeners some segments they could try at home. What are the 5 short segments people can imagine doing with family or friends?
Okay. Segment A, Ek Zaiqa, Ek Kahani. Invite someone to describe a childhood flavor and share the memory behind it. Segment B, Andaza versus Teaspoon. Try to write down an elder's recipe and discuss the differences. Segment C, Mehman ke liye khas. Recreate a special guest dish and talk about the labor it took. Segment D, Gum hote Zaiqe. Identify and document one flavor or ritual that's fading in your family. Segment E, Taste Experiment. Mindfully taste a food and note what memories or emotions arise.
Those are lovely, doable and meaningful. I can already picture listeners calling in with stories. Now, Hamza, before we wrap, can you give 3 key takeaways in your wise neuroscientist voice?
Sure. 1. Taste is memory. Smell and flavor are deeply wired into emotion and autobiographical memory.
2. Home shapes the tongue. Early exposure and family practices set lifelong palates. 3. Tradition is living, not frozen. Recipes evolve, meaning persists, and documenting embodied knowledge matters if we want to keep those micro variations alive.
Beautiful. I'll add one more. Every simple dish, dal, achar, chai, can carry stories of migration, gendered labor, and love. Okay, quick fun question. If you had to pick a signature smell to bring back a whole childhood for people, what would you pick, Hamza?
If I had to choose one, I'd pick the cumin garlic tadka hitting hot oil. It might seem ordinary, but it's widespread in our food culture and deeply evocative. Ammi ki dal, street stalls, home dinners, it pulls a lot of scenes.
Cumin garlic, got it. For me, I'd pick the smell of freshly fried pakore with monsoon rain outside. Instant childhood.
Monsoon pakore, iconic. These are great because they show how ordinary things can be extraordinary memory anchors.
Before we end, Hamza, one thing I'm curious about. In the research, do smells tend to evoke more positive memories than negative ones?
Good question. Research generally finds that odor-evoked memories tend to be more emotional and often positive, a nostalgic sweetness. They increase social connectedness and can improve mood. But of course, individual experiences vary. Smells can also trigger sadness, depending on the memory attached.
So, mostly good, but nuanced. Okay, last interactive thing. We want listeners to try a little exercise and send us a short voice note. What should they do and tell us, Hamza?
Ask them to do this. Take one bite or sip of something that reminds them of home. Close their eyes and in 60 seconds describe the memory it brings back. Where they were, who was there, what they felt. Send it to the show. We'll play a few in future episodes.
I love that. We want to hear those kitchen time machines. And while you're doing that, if someone wants a small reading list, where could they read more about the science behind smell and memory?
There are some accessible articles and chapters, The Neurobiology of Olfaction, for those who want depth, plus accessible pieces on why smells bring back vivid memories. Also look up studies on odor-evoked autobiographical memory and the so-called Proust effect. We'll link to resources in the episode notes.
Good. We'll make sure listeners have the links. Hamza, one friendly interruption. Do you think there's hope for some disappearing rituals? Can they be revived?
Gee, to an extent. Some practices can be revived through conscious effort. Community cooking days, recording elders, passing recipes in family gatherings. Others will change shape. Perhaps sun-drying on a rooftop becomes sun-drying on a balcony with a dehumidifier. But the meaning can continue. Revival needs both will and space in people's lives.
So it's partly practical and partly sentimental. I like that balance. Okay, we're getting close to the end. Final reflections, Hamza?
I would just say notice. Notice the smells in your home, the ways food carries memory, and the people who made those flavors possible. When we pay attention, we honor the intangible cultural heritage embedded in everyday dishes.
Beautiful. And my final line, make more meals with somebody. Even a simple dal tastes different when someone asks how you learned it. Thank you so much for sharing, Hamza.
Thank you, Sara. This was lovely, like a proper kitchen conversation.
Listeners, if you enjoyed this, subscribe, send us your 60-second smell memory voice notes, and tell a friend. We'll be back next week with another day story. Oh, one tiny teaser. Next episode, we'll try to capture a fading achar tradition. So if your family has a jar, get it ready.
Yes, bring your jars, bring your stories. And if you're making a recipe from an elder, try to record a short clip. We want to hear the andaza in action.
All right. Hamza, one last tiny question. What's your current comfort food? One sentence only.
Ammi's dal with warm roti. Always.
Mine. Chai with leftover paratha and sweet achar. Okay, that's that. Salaam and take care, everyone. Smell something nice today.
Salaam. And oh, remember, taste is a story, not just a flavor.
Bye for now.